children from their mothers. Paul bent his head, chin to chest, and pressed his palm to his mouth.
I'm sorry, Paul. Maybe this is too much for you.
No, you are right. I have to talk about it. You would not have believed the camp. That's Weiler.
In Alsace. Roger thought you might be there.
Yes, in the Vosges Mountains. Many died from the cold and the high altitude alone. I was such a coward. I prayed I would die. We built part of the camp, new barracks, and...
He tried to take a sip of tea, but put the cup back in the saucer.
Maybe we can finish later.
Of course, I said. Doesn't it help to talk about it?
Perhaps.
I tucked Paul into bed that night, happy to be making progress. The afternoon of May 8th, I was ankle-deep in the stream behind Paul's house picking watercress from the banks, marveling at the chestnut blossoms and emerging wisteria. Purple foxglove, a flower I'd had to pamper back in Connecticut, sprang up everywhere like weeds. I could hear Paul whistling in the house, and it made me smile. Men only whistle when they are happy. At least that was true for Father. All at once the whistling stopped, and Paul called out,
"Caroline!"
I ran through the grass toward the sound of his voice. Had he fallen? Heart pounding, I raced into the kitchen, tracking wet footprints.
"De Gaulle is on," Paul said.
I found Paul, right as rain, standing near the radio. I caught my breath, relieved. Just in time to hear General de Gaulle announce the end of the war in Europe.
"Forever honor our armed forces and their leaders. Honor our people that terrible trials could not reduce or decline. Honor the United Nations, which have mingled their blood with our blood. Their sorrows our sorrows, their hopes our hope, and now triumph with us. Ah, vive la France!"
Paul and I hurried to the front garden and heard the cathedral bells.
"It's hard to believe it," I said.
Though the first act of the German capitulation had been signed in Reims the day before, it wasn't until we heard General de Gaulle and our neighbors in their cars, honking horns and flying a tricolore out the window, that it all sank in. The war in Europe was over. I threw on one of Mother's scarves and drove us to her apartment in Paris. We flung the windows open wide, expecting to hear a great celebration. But Paris was strangely quiet that afternoon, considering the momentous news of the war's end. All that changed, however, as the afternoon wore on, and young people streamed out into the parks and squares.
"Let's go to the Place de la Concorde," Paul said.
"Why don't we just listen to the radio here?" I said. "The crowds may be too much for you."
"I'm not a cripple, Caroline. Let me enjoy this."
It was a lovely warm day, and we walked to the Hôtel de Crillon at the Place de la Concorde. The lovely old building rose up from the square, the tricolore flying between the columns. It was all so surreal, to celebrate a free France in the same square where King Louis XVI was guillotined. As the shadows in the square grew long, the crowds thickened, and American military police wearing white helmets appeared here and there in the crowd, making sure people made it in and out of the American embassy. We pushed through the crowds, the din of horns and singing all around us, waving white handkerchiefs above our heads, jostled and knocked as American army jeeps rode by. Young French men and women on the running boards popped champagne and threw flowers to the crowd. As the sunlight waned, The lights came on at the Place de la Concorde for the first time since the war started. A cry from the crowd went up as the Fontaines de la Concorde were turned on once again, and the fountain's sculpted fish, held by bronze sea nymphs, sent great plumes of water into the night sky. People danced in the fountain fully clothed and soaked to the skin, mad with happiness that Paris was back. Paul dropped his handkerchief, and a teenaged girl stooped to retrieve it for him.
"Here you go," the girl said.
"For a minute, I thought you were Paul Rodier."
"He is," I said. The girl danced off.
"Very funny,"
she called over her shoulder.
"She doesn't know what she's saying," I said.
But Paul knew the truth. He was barely a shell of his old self. The wind seemed to go out of Paul's sails after that, and we left after sunset to head home. As we drove toward Rouen, fireworks exploded over the Seine. Once home, we changed into comfortable clothes, me in Paul's soft trousers and an oversized shirt, and Paul in his favorite ivory flannel pajamas. He seemed withdrawn and more tired than usual. He sat slumped at the kitchen table as I prepared dinner.
"Are you sad Rena's not here?" I asked.
"It doesn't help to bring it up. As it is, you can't stop trying to be her."
"I'm not," I said.
"Cooking her recipes, dressing like her. Please don't do that."
"Because I wore a scarf today?" I asked.
"Just relax and let it be like it was in New York."
"I've never been happier," I said. It was true. We had our differences, but since I stopped typing up medication and exercise schedules for Paul, our relationship strengthened every day. Plus, thanks to the Woolsey remedies, Paul was finally filling out.
"Then why don't you move in? For good, I mean."
"Oh, I don't know, Paul.
It would help to hear how you feel."
"I'm crazy about you."
"How so?"
Paul thought for a second.
"You are a very hard worker. I respect this."
"That's it."
"And I like the way you speak French with your American accent. Very sexy."
"Certainly, that isn't."
"And I never tire of being with you."
He stood and came to me at the sink.
"I like your imperfections, your lopsided smile."
I touched my lips.
"Lopsided?"
"And you don't have a giant handbag you're always pawing through."
He took my hand.
"I like that you wear my clothes."
He unbuttoned one button at my chest.
"And your white skin, so smooth all over. I thought of that a lot while I was away."
He wrapped his arms around my waist.
"But my favorite thing about you is..."
"Well?"
"The way you kiss. Sometimes I think I may not recover when I kiss you. It's like going to another place."
Paul pulled my shirt collar aside and kissed my neck. I smiled.
"Funny. There's one word you never use."
Paul stepped back.
"Why do Americans have to have every detail spelled out? You say, 'I love you,' to the garbage man."
"I believe the phrase was invented here."
"If that's all it takes, I love you. I can't imagine a life without you. Now move your things in, your clothes, your books. Make the house ours."
"You mean not go back to New York?"
It was too wonderful to imagine, being with Paul for good.
"Yes. Make this your home. We can always visit New York, and your mother can move here,
You already have the apartment?
I'll miss the consulate. But Roger has Pia.
He certainly does.
Of course I'll stay, I said.
Good, then,
Paul said with a smile. It was like medicine to see that smile again. Was it too late to have a baby together? I was over 40 years old. We could always adopt. There was a file in my suitcase full of darling French babies who needed homes. We'd have a real family. Mother would be thrilled to have a wedding at last. Roger had wrangled her a visa, and she was on her way to Paris for a visit after all. I could tell her in person.
Why not start tonight? He said.
I'll go get my things. Was this really happening? Did I have any silk stockings at Mother's apartment?
Don't bring any makeup, Paul said. You are perfect as is.
Not even a lipstick.
Hurry. I'll finish making dinner.
Please don't, Paul, I said. Dr. Bedreau says...
Paul stood and walked to the counter. He scooped a few dusky new potatoes, the color of violets, from the bowl.
Would it be too much for him to make a meal?
Don't say another word, or I will change my mind, he said.
I grabbed my purse. Nietzsche said a diet predominantly of potatoes leads to the use of liquor.
Good. Bring a bottle of your mother's wine. We're celebrating.
In the almost 2-hour drive back to Paris, I made a mental list of what to pack. Capri pants, silk stockings, my new lingerie. I would eventually need a proper French driver's license. At the apartment, I drew the shades, threw a suitcase together, and headed out. As I locked the door, the phone rang in the kitchen, and for once in my life I ignored it. If it was Mother, I needed more time to tell her the whole story. On the trip back, I stopped at our favorite market and found one sorry-looking baguette, small but a good omen. I stopped again to stoke the engine with wood and headed for Rouen. The car radio turned up, windows open, as Léo Margène sang Alone Tonight. I am alone tonight with my dreams. The papers all chastised the cabaret singer for having entertained the Nazis a little too enthusiastically during the occupation, but no song captured the war like that one. I sang along. I am alone tonight without your love. It was wonderful not to be the one alone for once. Sad songs are not so sad when you have someone who loves you. I turned onto Paul's street, singing with abandon. Who cared what the neighbors thought? I rounded the bend and saw a white ambulance parked at the curb outside Paul's house, engine running. Time stopped. Was it parked at the wrong house? I drove closer and saw a nurse standing outside the front door, a navy blue cape over her white uniform. My God! Paul! The car barely stopped moving before I jumped from it. I ran up the walk. Is Paul hurt? I said, my breath coming in great gulps. Come, quickly, the nurse said as I followed her into the house.
Chapter 28, Kasha, 1945. Am I dreaming? Susanna said as the ferry docked at Gdansk, the salt air filled with the wild cries of gulls and terns. I lifted my hand to shield my eyes, for the sparkling water, alive with diamonds, blinded me. We had spent 2 months in Malmö, Sweden, the place for which God saved all the most beautiful things in nature, the greenest grass, sky the color of cornflowers, children who seemed born of that landscape, their hair spun from white clouds, eyes of cobalt sea. We were sorry to leave, for we were treated like royalty there, feasting on princess cake and pitepal dumplings with butter and lingonberry jam. Once we regained our strength, both Susanna and I were up to 40 kilos, many of us wanted to get home to wherever that might be. Poland, France, Czechoslovakia. A few women with little left to go home to stayed in Sweden to start new lives. Some waited to see what would happen with the proposed new elections in Poland before they ventured back. We'd heard the repressive Soviet law enforcement agency, NKVD, was in charge in Poland, but Susanna and I never hesitated. We ached to see Papa. While I was grateful beyond words for my rescue, the stronger I became, the angrier I got. Where was the joy at being rescued? I watched women around me recover, eager to resume their old lives. But for me, the rage just grew, black in my belly. Once we'd made it to the northern coast of Poland by ferry, a driver met us at the landing. He was a young man from Warsaw, one of more than 100 former Polish Air Force pilots who joined Britain's Royal Air Force and risked their lives fighting the Luftwaffe. He was only a few years my senior, but at 22, I had the limp and posture of an old crone. He reached for Susanna's cloth sack and helped us into the car. I felt the leather of the back seat, cool and smooth. How long had it been since I'd been in an automobile? It may as well have been a spaceship. "So what is happening in the world today?" Susanna said once we were underway, opening and closing the little metal ashtray in her door handle. I opened my own and found two crooked cigarettes stubbed out there. What they would have given for those in the camp.
"Heard what's going on with the government?" the driver asked.
"There are to be free elections," Susanna said. We drove through the port of Gdansk, bombed heavily during the war.
"The government in exile wants to come back," the driver said. "So the Polish Workers' Party says there will be a vote."
"You believe Stalin?" I said.
"The Polish Workers' Party is..."
"Stalin. Just what we need.
They say we'll be our own free and independent country. People are hopeful."
"Why do we keep believing liars?" I asked. "The NKVD will never let go."
"Don't let anyone hear you say that," the driver said. "That sounds free and independent," I said.
Susanna and I slept much of the way to Lublin and woke, once the driver stopped, at our front door.
"Time to wake up, ladies,"
the driver said as he pulled on the handbrake. We sat in the back seat and stared at the bare light bulb next to our front door, bright in the darkness, inviting a frenzied party of fat moths and other bugs. At Ravensbrück, prisoners would have happily eaten those. "Can you believe we are here?" Susanna asked. We stepped out of the car as if we were arriving on the moon. I circled Susanna's waist with my arm. She leaned against me, and her hip bone knocked mine. The pain in my bad leg spiked as I climbed those beautiful front steps. We had sent Papa a telegram. Would he be waiting with poppy seed cake and tea for us? I turned the old porcelain knob of our apartment door. It was locked. Susanna fished the extra key out of the old hiding place behind the brick. Still there. One step into the kitchen, and the realization knocked the wind out of me. My mother was gone. The room was dark, save for a small lamp on the kitchen table and the halo of a candle flame on the fireplace mantel. Two happy yellow curtains hung at the windows, and a new family of red canisters stood on Matka's wooden counter. Yellow and red. Matka loved blue. Someone had hung a painting of a field of wildflowers over the wall where Matka once pasted her bird pictures. A few sparrows peeked out from behind the painting, the mucilage holding them to the wall, yellowed with age. I walked to Matka's drawing table. Someone had laid it flat and covered it with a cheap lace tablecloth. Atop it, a Virgin Mary picture from a shrine in Greifswald, and a china frame containing a picture of an old woman waving from a train. I stepped to the mantel, to Matka's picture there, the one where she looked quite serious and was holding her little dog Boris. Someone had set a black bow beneath the photo, the curled ends hanging down off the mantel. I felt dizzy standing there looking at my mother's solemn face as it danced in the candlelight. A dog barked in the bedroom, and Susanna caught her breath. Felka?
Who is there? Papa said, creeping down the hall from the back bedroom.
He came toward us in his striped underwear. His hair, thinned and gray as a squirrel's coat, poked out in all directions, a black revolver I'd never seen before in his hand. Felka emerged behind him, her tail beating quite a rhythm. She was all grown up and fatter than the last time I'd seen her, right in that kitchen with Matka. It is just us, Papa, Susanna said. Papa stood as if struck dumb, his mouth open. How had he aged so? Even the hair on his chest was gray. Felka came to us and ran back and forth from Susanna to me, digging her wet nose into us. We're home, I said, my eyes pricked with tears. Papa opened his arms wide and we went to him. He set his gun on the counter and hugged us both as if he would never let us go. How happy we were to be there in his embrace. Susanna and I both cried on his bare shoulders. Did you not receive our telegram? I asked.
Who receives telegrams these days?
You got a letter about Matka?
Yes. The handwriting on the envelope looked like hers, so I thought it was a letter from her, but it was a form letter. They said it was typhus.
I took his hand. It wasn't typhus, Papa.
What then?
He was like a small child. Where was my strong Papa? I don't know, I said. He stepped back, hands on his hips.
But were you not together?
Susanna led Papa to a kitchen chair. They moved her to a separate block, Papa. She worked as a nurse.
And drew portraits for the Nazis. That's what got her killed, getting too close to them.
Why did I say such a thing? I knew too well that her bringing me a sandwich that night at the movie theater had gotten her killed. Susanna knelt next to Papa. You received Kasia's letters. How did you know how to read them?
It took the whole postal center to figure it out. We knew there was some sort of code, but none of us knew how to read it. I dabbed water on the first letter, but then we figured it out. I told certain people, and they got the message to our underground in London, who spread the word. But it was Marta who said we should iron the letter, that it was a trick from a book she knew.
Marta? I knelt at Papa's other side. Thank you for the red thread.
I got the word out as best I could. Did you know the BBC broadcast it?
What they did to you both. Papa dissolved into another pool of tears. How hard it was to see our strong Papa crying. I took his hand. Have you seen Pietrik? Nadia?
No, neither of them. I post the lists every day. Red Cross Center does too. I wish we'd known you were coming.
Papa took up a linen dishcloth and dried his tears.
We've been frantic with worry.
We? Susanna noticed her first, in the shadows of the bedroom doorway, a thick-set woman in a dressing gown. Susanna went to her and put out her hand. I am Susanna, she said. A woman in Papa's bedroom?
I am Marta, the woman said. I've heard so many nice things about you both.
I stood, took a deep breath, and considered the woman. Marta was a few inches taller than Papa. Her dressing gown belted with twine. Brown hair worn in a braid hung down over her lapel. A countrywoman. Papa had certainly lowered his standards. Marta came to stand near to Papa, but he made no move toward her.
Marta's from a village outside of Zamość. A great help to me these years you've been away.
Papa looked embarrassed Marta was there. Who wouldn't? Introducing his girlfriend to his dead wife's children?
Why don't we sit? Marta said. I would like to go to bed, I said. It was like a swap out at the market. My eyes went to Matka's picture on the mantel. Did Papa not miss her? How could he do it?
Papa waved me to him. Sit with us, Kasia. Marta sat on Matka's favorite chair, the one she had painted white with a calico pillow seat. I watched Susanna bond with Marta. Papa looked on, happy to see them connect.
I wish we could offer you something to eat, but we just finished the last of the bread, Marta said.
Papa felt the stubble of his beard.
It is worse than ever now. Since the Russians came, there is barely any food at all. At least the Nazis kept the bakers in flour.
So we've traded Nazis for Stalin, I asked.
Even trade, if you ask me. I get on well with them, Papa said. They have let me keep my job at the center.
Let you? I asked.
You can get all the Russian cigarettes you want now, Marta said, a little too brightly. But few eggs.
It is just a matter of time before we are all calling one another comrade, I said.
We'll get on just fine, Susanna said. They are looking for former underground members, Papa said with a pointed look at me. They took Mazur last week.
A volt of current went through me, and all of a sudden I could barely breathe. Mazur? He was Pietrik's childhood friend, a most skilled agent at the highest ranks of the underground. He'd read me my AK oath, a true patriot. Big breath in, big breath out.
I'm done with all that, I said.
They took us from the camp on a Swedish bus, Susanna said. You should have seen it as we crossed the border to Denmark. All the people gathered there with welcome signs. They were very nice to us in Sweden, too. We flew the Lublin Girl Guides banner someone had found in the Ravensbrück booty piles as we drove in, and you should have heard the cheers. We spent the first night on the floor of a museum.
With dinosaurs with big teeth crouched over us, I said. No different from the camp.
Susanna fetched her cloth sack. Then we stayed with the princess at her mansion. Look what they gave us before we left Sweden. She opened the sack, set a white box on the table, and opened it. They gave each of us one. Tin sardines, white bread and butter, berry jam and a piece of chocolate. We had each taken only nibbles of the food, saving it.
And evaporated milk, Papa said.
It's been so long.
How kind of them, Marta said. I have a flower ticket I've been saving. I can make...
Don't trouble yourself, I said. Papa bowed his head and ran his fingers through what was left of his hair.
I am sorry about your mother, Marta said, standing. It looks like it, I said.
Kasia, Papa said.
I picked up the white chair, the cushion still warm from Marta's rump.
Good night, Papa, I said.
Good night, Susanna.
I carried Matka's chair toward my room, passing the mantle, careful to avert my eyes from Matka's picture there. It was too hard to look at her face. A new knock to the belly every time. I entered my room and closed the door. No mistress of my father's would park in my mother's seat, no matter how much help she was to him.
Chapter 29 Caroline 1945 I followed the nurse into the house and saw an ambulance attendant in the kitchen at the end of the hall. Even from the front door, I could see the potatoes scattered on the floor, the shine of olive oil on tile. How could I have left Paul alone after Dr. Bedreau's warnings? As we neared the kitchen, I saw Paul seated at the table, a nurse taking his pulse. A gush of warmth rushed through my arms. "You're okay, Paul. Thank God." Paul looked at me. Had he been crying?
"We tried to phone you. Can you believe it, Caroline? It's almost like a dream."
I shook my head. "I don't understand."
"They rang the doorbell," he said. "It's all so surreal."
"Who rang the doorbell, Paul?"
"Rena."
"Rena rang the doorbell? You're not making sense."
"They just took her upstairs."
"She's back?" My voice sounded distant, foreign. Paul rubbed a spot on the tablecloth.
"She has been at the American hospital."
Did he seem happy? Not really. It was all so confusing.
"She hasn't been able to talk much. Seems a German family took her in."
I slumped against the door jamb. "How wonderful," was the only thing I could think to say. "I'd better go now." I turned to leave.
"Caroline, wait," Paul said. "Where are you going?"
"This is all so overwhelming."
"I know. I am sorry, Caroline. Rena has been in the hospital for weeks. Too ill to speak."
"I am sorry." I hated those three words. How many times had people said that when Father died? Je suis désolé sounds beautiful in French, but it only made things worse. "Well, I have to go home," I said. I needed time to think and didn't want to break down in front of him. After all, a woman was alive and had not died a tragic death in a concentration camp. She was no doubt tucked into Paul's bed upstairs as we spoke. Paul stared at the potatoes on the floor.
"Yes, we'll talk tomorrow."
"I mean home to Connecticut," I said.
"You can't go home now? This is a shock for all of us."
"I can't think straight. I have to go." Why didn't he throw his arms around me and beg me to stay?
"We'll talk tomorrow and figure all of this out," Paul said, still rooted in his chair.
Somehow I made it out to the car and back to Mother's apartment, where I committed myself to voluntary confinement, mostly in bed, dressed in pajama bottoms and Paul's shirt I'd worn home from his house. The kitchen phone rang a few times until I took the receiver off the hook and left it dangling.
"Si vous souhaitez faire un appel, s'il vous plaît, raccrochez et réessayez,"
said the recording over and over again until there was a series of short beeps, and then nothing. The door buzzer rang several times a day, but I didn't answer it. I self-flagellated by day, allowed my hot tea to cool and then drank it tepid and over-milked, and steeped myself in could-have-beens. Could have been lasting love. Could have been a wedding. A baby. Had I really hawked half of Mother's silver to nurse another woman's husband back to health? Betty was right. I had wasted my time. One morning, Mother let herself into the apartment and planted herself in my bedroom doorway, her umbrella dripping on the carpet.
"Mother, I'd forgotten she was due to arrive."
"It's pouring out there," she said.
"Good," I thought.
At least others were inside and as miserable as I. Heavenly day, Caroline. What is wrong? Are you ill? Why don't you answer the phone? I may not have been French, but was I not allowed to take to my bed and marinate in my own despair? Paul's wife came back, I said. What? From the dead? How is this possible? Where was she all this time? I don't know. Some hospital. That is incredible, Mother said. Well, you have to pull yourself together. I can't, I said and pulled the duvet up over my shoulders. You are taking a bath and I'm making you tea. A bath makes everything better. There was no fighting, Mother, and she was right about the bath. I emerged in fresh pajamas and sat at the metal garden table in the kitchen. I knew this would never work, I said. I'm not meant to be happy. Mother brought me a Mariage Frere Earl Grey tea bag and a cup and a pot of hot water. Sorrow is knowledge. Please, Mother, no Byron just now. This whole thing has been a ridiculous fantasy. How did I let myself get so carried away? I should have known. I had to try so hard to make it work. Just because he has a wife doesn't mean you can't be with him, Mother said. A few hours in France had thrown her moral compass for a loop. I suppose. But why is it always so hard, Mother? There's always some catch. The doorbell buzzed. I reached for Mother's wrist. Don't answer it. Mother went to the door anyway, an action that made me regret inviting her to France. Whoever it is, I'm not here, I called after her. Mother answered the door. I heard a woman introduce herself as Rena. Oh, God. Rena? Anyone but her. Mother came back to the kitchen with Rena in tow and then left us alone. Rena stood in the doorway in a cotton dress that clung to her like wet laundry, showing the ridge of her collarbone and a hollow the size of a soup bowl below.
Sorry to interrupt your tea, Caroline, she said.
A tired schoolgirl, all eyes and sunken cheeks.
I tried to call.
Her gaze drifted to the dangling receiver.
Oh,
I said. Rena shifted in her shoes.
Paul is sorry as well. Tried to call you too. Please sit, I said.
Rena ran one finger behind her ear, as if to tuck a piece of hair there. An old habit, it seemed, for there was no hair there to tuck.
I will not take up too much of your time. Just wanted to say how sorry I am.
Sorry? I poured hot water over the muslin bag. The scent of bergamot orange triggered a violent craving for one of Sergei's violet scones.
For how this all turned out? She said.
No need to apologize, Rena.
Maybe I will sit. I won't be long.
Of course, I said.
Tea? No, thank you. I still can't keep much down. I told Paul he should come over soon and visit, explain it all.
I tried to sip my tea but could not see the cup because my head throbbed so. My vision blurred.
I am afraid Paul is not happy to see me, she said.
Somewhere out on the street, children laughed, their voices echoing off the buildings as they splashed in the rain.
You probably wish I were dead after all,
Rena said.
Believe me, I wish that myself so often. I would have sent word if I could have. It was just luck that kept me alive.
I understand.
No, I don't think you do. How could you? It was just luck they broke with the usual procedure. They had taken our shoes, so we knew.
Rena, you don't have to...
We were on the train from Majdanek to a sub-camp, we thought. The train slowed somewhere in Poland, and they made us get out.
Rena paused and looked out the window.
I was sick. Typhus, I think. So I barely made it when they marched us through the woods. Paper money lay scattered on the ground along the path. People before us had thrown it away. Unless the Germans got it, I suppose. Someone whispered we were going to work, but I knew. We came to a shed, and they told us to strip.
Please, Rena, you don't have to tell me. I am sorry. Is all of this too hard for you to listen to?
I shook my head no.
It happened so quickly. They lined us up along the edge of a great pit.
Rena lost her thread and drifted away somewhere. After a moment, she began again.
When the girl beside me saw what was below, she cried out. Her mother took her in her arms, and they shot them first. The blasts threw them against me, and all three of us slid down the dirt sides.
Rena paused, and I barely blinked, afraid to interrupt.
I lay still as more bodies fell atop me. Soon the shots stopped, and I could tell it was close to night, since the light through the spaces around the bodies above me grew dim. I crawled out of the pit in the dark and rooted around in the shed for some clothes.
She looked at the ceiling.
You should have seen the stars that night, thrown across the sky in great bunches. It was as if they were watching, looking down on all that, sad they could do nothing. I walked through the woods to a house, and a farmer and his wife took me in. A German couple. Their son had been killed at the Russian front. At first, the wife was afraid I would steal her wristwatch. A nice one. A gift from her son. For the wristwatch is valuable currency. But the couple ended up being very kind. They put me in their boy's old bed and nursed me through my sickness as if I were their own. Fed me warm bread with strawberry jam. I returned their hospitality by passing on my disease.
I handed Rena a napkin, and she held it to one eye for a moment, then the other.
The old man died first. When the Russians came, I told them we all had typhus. But they laid a rug over my face and raped me anyway. Then they raped the farmer's wife and took her wristwatch. She died sometime that night. I don't remember much else, just bits and pieces, until the hospital here.
So, you see, I would have come home earlier, but it was... I'm sorry that happened to you, Rena. Why are you telling me all this?
I know what Paul means to you.
He told you?
When he first returned from New York. I didn't care at the time, but things are different now.
Of course things were different, in ways none of us could undo.
I wish I could make you happy, Caroline, but I can't give Paul up. Maybe once, but not now.
Rena held the edge of the table. She needed to rest.
I think you should go home to him, Rena.
Yes, but I need to tell you something.
There was more?
I don't think I haven't told Paul yet.
She drew herself up with a deep breath.
Rena, it's not really...
They took Paul before any of us. I was very sick, could eat nothing, thought it was the flu, but then I found I was, well, waiting for a child.
The world stopped for a moment, suspended in air.
Waiting for a child. That lovely French phrase. Pregnant?
Rena held my gaze and barely nodded.
Was it?
I began before I could stop myself.
Is?
Rena looked at her hands for a long time.
War does funny things to people, I am afraid. In our case, it drew us closer.
The child must have known what was happening. She arrived the day the Gestapo came for me. Easter morning.
She? Paul had a daughter. I pressed cold fingers to my lips.
We were tipped off that a raid was coming. My father took the child, said he would go to a convent he knew.
He took her in a shoebox. She was so small.
Where?
I don't know. They came for me that night. My father had not returned.
I'm terribly sorry for your loss, but I...
The convent was abandoned during the war, so I am writing to orphanages, but Paul told me...
I'm really not in a position to help, if that's what you're asking.
I stood and carried my teacup to the sink.
I understand your reluctance, Caroline. I wouldn't want to be involved if I myself were in your place. But if you reconsider...
I'm leaving for New York soon, I said, one hand on the cool porcelain of the sink. Rena stood.
Of course. Thank you for your time, Caroline.
I saw Rena to the door and watched from our front window as she walked to the end of the block, holding her purse over her head to deflect the rain. The thought of contacting orphan asylums in search of Paul and Rena's child sent me back to bed. Despite the fact that he had once claimed otherwise, it seemed there was room in Paul's life for a child after all. Why should I put myself out to find her? Paul hadn't exactly considered my feelings through all of this. I may have been taken in once, but I'd learned my lesson. There were plenty of private detectives making a living searching for lost loved ones. Many who'd do a better job than I. By the time evening fell in the apartment, I'd decided. Paul and Rena were on their own. Chapter 30. Caroline. 1945. The next morning I woke up hungry, my belly only full of regret. It was shocking how easily my life had become derailed. The French word dépaysement ran through my head. The sense of disorientation one feels upon having an immense change forced upon oneself. Mother had done a yeoman's job of dusting, but all at once the apartment looked especially unkempt. The windows in need of washing, the telephone cord impossibly tangled. Mother's solution to my situation was to force-feed me eggs as if I were a foie gras goose. Midway through her œuf poché, I shared my situation.
Did you hear my little chat with Rena?
Only bits. She seems like a dear thing.
I suppose.
But she's not giving Paul up.
That's a pickle.
Not really.
Isn't it obvious? He still loves her.
Mother cracked another egg into the boiling water. How would you know? You don't answer the phone. Paul leaned on the doorbell for an hour last night, poor thing.
5 minutes, Mother. Don't exaggerate.
It's too bad, really. Under different circumstances, you and Rena could have been good pals.
I have enough friends, Mother, thank you.
Well, you can't just turn your back on the whole thing, dear.
I'll never have a child of my own.
But that doesn't mean it's right to abandon theirs. Before you know it, you'll be wondering,
"Summarize, Mother. You think I should find that child?"
She slipped another egg into my bowl. Well, it's the Christian thing to do.
I'm not feeling very Christian this morning, I'm afraid.
Well, splash some cold water on your face. That will help.
Why was Mother's solution to every problem a splash of cold water? Already a day with her in the apartment felt like an eternity. How would I last the week? Soon her Paris friends would be stopping by. Would I have to suffer their pitying looks? Eventually, I came to my senses and set about finding the child, if for no other reason than to put it all behind me. And to escape the apartment. For Mother was staging a tribute to T.S. Eliot, the Paris years, and the guests had been instructed to come in costume. Among the visitants would be some of Mother's men friends, no doubt. Though I'd not been able to keep even one male admirer, within weeks of coming to Paris, Mother had attracted a bevy of male devotees, mostly bereaved older Frenchmen and American expats. They sat in our living room sipping tea, watching Mother be Mother, and were happy to be in her orbit. Finding an unnamed child in post-war France was not an easy process. And I arrived at the end of my rope after many stops at Orphelinat Saint-Philippe in Meudon. It was one of the orphanages I'd sent comfort packages to from the consulate, and now one of many clearinghouses for the war's displaced children, collected from safe houses, boarding schools, and crumbling chateaux all over France, mostly in the south. It stood southwest of Paris in an imposing old stone mansion, complete with its own Romanesque church. The location rivaled Mount Olympus, set high on a hill, head in the clouds that day. I darted through the warm rain, having foregone an umbrella, and navigated the mossy steps. I tried not to think about what would happen if I found the child. It would be the official end of our relationship, despite everything Paul and I once had. Apparently, he was in love with Rena after all, at least enough to father her child. The orphanage's front office was packed with people on missions similar to mine. Those wise enough to bring umbrellas held them at their sides like wet bats, for there was no stand at the door. A phone rang unanswered, and cardboard boxes were piled up in the corners. Stacks of white diapers sat on the desk, like layered milfoy pastries, diaper pins scattered about. The crowd parted, and a man pushed his way in carrying a wailing infant wrapped in linen. He made it to the desk and held out the infant as if it were a live bomb.
"An old granny just handed me this."
The proprietress behind the desk took the child. She was a hawk-like woman dressed in black, her only embellishment an exquisite collar that looked like Queen Anne's lace. She placed the bundle on the desk and unwrapped layers of linen. She looked up, a mauve crescent beneath each eye.
"This is a boy. We take only girls."
The man was already on his way out the door.
"Guillaume!"
she called, as she reswaddled the baby, quicker than a deli man wraps a sandwich, and a man came at a trot, took the child, and spirited it away. A young woman approached the desk.
"Madame?"
Madame raised one finger without even looking up from her paperwork.
"Wait your turn. The children are at lunch. No one sees them until 3.
Drips of water from the leaky ceiling fell on the desk blotter, leaving darker green amoebas growing there.
"Pardon me, madame," I said. "I am looking for a child."
She scanned the list on her clipboard.
"Fill out the form,"
she said. I edged closer.
"I have a special case,"
You are the fifth special case today.
My name is Caroline Faraday. I worked with Madame Bertillon, sent comfort boxes for the children, from the French consulate in New York. The woman looked up, tipped her head to one side.
You sent the boxes. The children cherished the clothing. Exquisitely done.
In fact, I sent that Ovaltine over there as well. I indicated an empty cardboard box.
Thank you, mademoiselle, but we sold that for next to nothing. The children complained it tasted like bird's nest and wouldn't drink it, I'm afraid. We need money, Miss Faraday, not Ovaltine.
I took from the desk a tin can containing withered tulips, tossed the flowers into the waste basket, and placed the can on the blotter to contain the drip. I know you are terribly busy, madame, but I am looking for a child. Madame eyed me.
Your child?
No, the parents were deported and are just now getting on their feet.
I am sorry, but I can only deliver a child to the parent or blood relative. Two forms of identification required.
I am just trying to locate the child. Her parents will collect her.
Come with me, Madame said.
She grabbed her clipboard and a towering pile of nested tin bowls, and I followed her up wide stone steps. As we walked, Madame placed a tin bowl here and there as she found more drips. Any chance I can meet Madame Bertillon? I asked.
I am Madame Bertillon.
How was that possible? You wrote such lovely letters, I said.
Some people are better on paper,
Madame said with a tired shrug. Had she slept at all the night before?
What is the child's name?
I'm not sure, Madame. It was all done in a hurry. The mother was deported on the birthday.
Which was?
April 1st, 1941, Easter Sunday.
Nazis deported people on Easter. Shocking those good men were not in church.
Could you check your records?
You are looking at my records, mademoiselle.
She held up the clipboard, a sheaf of paper thick as a telephone book clamped there, ragged and marked with crossouts and burgundy Olympic rings of wine stains.
We are a collection point for children from all over Europe. This will be a difficult search.
We walked into a high-ceilinged room filled with cots, each with a pillow and folded blanket at the foot. How do you identify the children? I asked.
Each is assigned a number. This number is printed on a small disc pinned to the chest. Some children came with names. Many did not.
Madame placed her bowls on a chair.
During the war, some mothers wrote their child's name on a paper note and pinned it to the child before they dropped them here. But most notes fell off or were blurred in the brain. Some sewed trinkets to their children's clothes so they could identify them later, but many children changed clothes and swapped names with others. We still get several anonymous drop-offs daily.
Surely some children remember their own names.
The older ones, perhaps. But many arrive here mute from their terrible experiences. And a baby doesn't remember its name, does it? So we assigned them. We named them after their birth month, if they knew it. You will find many Mays and Juins here. We named some after the patron saint of their birth month, or after our friends and relatives, even pets.
Can you at least check which children came in on that day? I asked.
It is not consistently noted. These children are coming from all over. Safe houses, boarding schools, from farmers who found them sleeping in haystacks. Some brought here by the only parents they've ever known find out for the first time they are not who they think they are.
You must be overrun with parents searching.
Some. But most of the children here will not be placed. Their parents are long gone, or don't want them.
No one would not want their own child.
Really, mademoiselle, you are an expert on this.
Over one quarter of the children here are mixed. German father, French mother. Kraut kids, they call them. No one will be picking those children up.